grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 290 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming to you live tonight from Austin, Texas. We're talking a heavy topic tonight, one that is very close to our hearts here on the show, and that is the Route 91 shooting. As of the 1st of October, it was 3 years since the day of this fateful incident, what is now officially the largest mass shooting in American history. Let's take a minute just to get a grasp of what that evening was like for some of those people that were attending. Route 91 Harvest Festival, what was actively going on that night. We have had our good friend Shannon Caffey on the show before to talk about his experience there, his survival of that night with his wife. We also had our good friends Maurice McCoy on. He was out running camera that night and actively jumped over a fence to get away from everything. As well as our first guest that we had on about this, Mike Cargill, owner of Central Texas Gunworks, who had put out a video shortly after the shooting saying that this was guaranteed, like, he owns Central Texas Gunworks. He was like, I guarantee you this is a bump stock. This is not fully automatic firearms. This is a bump stock. And all that came out. We had him on the show. This has been one of the going concerns for Dudes and Beer. There have been a few that have really kind of changed the course of this show, I think, and really, really kind of taken us down a beautiful rabbit hole for the chase for truth, the chase for knowledge, the chase for facts that we as the citizenry of America deserve. And when you're talking about mass shootings, when you're talking about something as horrific as what happened that night at the hands of Stephen Paddock at the Route 91 Festival from the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay, that is definitely one of those that there are a lot of unanswered questions. This investigation was taken on in a total slipshod manner. They had, like, the first briefing within 12 hours of, here's a timeline of everything that happened. We got one shooter. And yet still saying that they were exploring all options. Right now, we will watch the actual trailer for the amazing movie. I watched it twice in the last week. It is now officially, as of the 1st, the 3rd anniversary of this fateful incident. Money Machine, the documentary made by Ram Dennison, as well as produced by our good friend Mike Turber, is now officially available on Amazon as well as iTunes. It's charting on iTunes, I believe, number 25 right now. So for only being there for 5 days, that is absolutely amazing. He has won all kind of awards. Let's check out real quick the trailer for Money Machine.
We are talking about the largest mass shooting in the history of the United States.
This is a crazed lunatic.
My brother just killed 58 people.
My dad was on the 10 most wanted FBI list. We're not normal people.
Steve gambled $1.6 million at the Mandalay in the week before he did this. He was really, really angry with the gaming industry.
There's been accusations that there's multiple shooters. That has been proven to be false.
You had politicians grandstanding on this Vegas Strong movement to get elected.
Vegas Strong.
I'm turning tragedy into opportunity.
It was an election year, and it was camera time for Lombardo and his friends.
I want to thank Sheriff Lombardo for your leadership.
I'm getting faced up every day.
almost every press conference, you saw one figure, and that was Steve Sisolak, using this as a springboard for his political campaign.
He used the tragedy to get elected.
While the hashtag Vegas Strong campaign raised over $10 million, less than $20,000 were distributed to the victims in the first 5 months.
If they came out and said what really happened, I think they're afraid of a period of time where people say it's not safe to go to Vegas.
And nothing happens in Las Vegas without the ring of a cash register.
MGM Resorts is suing the victims.
They are being sued for getting shot.
Shameful, disgusting, outrageous.
The newly released video shows Las Vegas police waiting in the hallway as Stephen Paddock continues to murder people.
Oh my God.
Lives could have been saved if they would have taken action.
They were fibbing the whole time about being such big heroes. They're hiding in the hallway.
I asked them, are you stupid or are you incompetent?
Please stop asking your questions.
You hear officers directly saying, turn your cameras off.
I'm telling you right now, there's more than one shooter.
There could be as many as three.
We saw multiple muzzle flashes coming out that window.
There is no conspiracy.
Can't trust this!
Available now on video on demand.
And there it is, the absolutely awesome trailer. Welcome to the show, Ram Dennison, Mike Turber. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm great. Thanks.
I'm doing excellent myself. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to come on and talk about this. As I said at the top of the show, this is really one of the many causes that we've gotten behind. Things like human trafficking, targeted individuals, stuff like that. Things that really skim under the headlines of most mainstream media, but are there, and they're the seedy underbelly of our society. And if we don't have this conversation, we're going to go down so many horrible, horrible places. And this is one of them. To know that right now, we still don't have motive, full motive for Stephen Paddock. We have a decent suspicion of what he may have done, why he may have done it, but we don't know actually. We have a police department that has lied repeatedly during the course of this, and a slipshod investigation that took, less than a year to wrap up with one of the largest crime scenes since 9/11? So...
Yep, you would think it was over within 2 hours based on the instant news conferences and everything. It was all wrapped up.
Yeah, precisely. So... before we really start digging into this, because I know Ram has limited time this evening with us, but I really want to get into a little bit of the backstory here real quick, how you and Mike started working together, Ram, how you guys met, and what really brought this project together for both of you guys, and what was the catalyst behind Money Machine?
I think I met Mike the first time at the 6 month anniversary of October. And Mike is like known as the guy who always has like 1,000 weird, strange objects in his truck.
Yeah.
So at any given time,
I've met
this particular trip, I believe that he had 1,000 shrink wrapped Starbucks donuts in his truck. And there was no real explanation of how this happened or why, but there was just, it was just, hey, I've got 1,000 donuts. And then the next time I saw Mike, he had 1,000 of something else in his car. And so I was just like, wow, this guy's kind of interesting and maybe a little shady.
a little off the wall.
So that was the first encounter with Mike. And then what happened was, you know, we started talking about working together and stuff. And then Mike kind of called me, you know, we wanted to get an interview with Eric Paddock, but Eric wasn't real big on doing any more interviews after the initial ones he did with the news. And so I remember Mike kind of called me randomly one day and just said, hey, man, I got Eric Paddock. He's willing to do an interview. And I'm like, you're kidding me. He's like, no, I got him. I can get him on another phone in a minute. And sure enough. So I learned pretty quick that Mike was a guy, even though like, he always had, you know, weird things in his car and such. Was also very reliable in addition to, you know.
I told Ramsey when I first met him, I said, the chances are you'll be around me when some weird, crazy crap happens, and it just tends to fall in my lap. And he's like, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, over time, I think that's come true.
Come to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, and I mean, once again, before we really start digging into this, you guys not only have the accolade of Money Machine right now, which got written up in Forbes, all kinds of stuff. Like, y'all got some rave reviews on this. Like I said, I've had a chance to watch it twice. Not only did it pass the wife test in wife watching it and enjoying it, which is pretty rare for the material that we do on Dudes and Beer. For my wife to watch a documentary with me and go, wow, that was really good. You know, most of the time she's like, okay, all right. Okay.
It's more than the Brits reviews, man.
Not only that, it was the fact that today, our 8th anniversary. Happy anniversary, Amy. I love you so much. Thank you for letting me do Dudes and Beer on my birthday. Or not my birthday.
Thank you, Amy.
But on our anniversary, happy birthday to my niece at the same time, my little cousin. And yeah, it's just one of those. It was crazy. The fact that I was like, baby, I want to watch this again today so that I have it fresh in my mind for tonight. And she was like, oh, yeah, that was good. Okay. And I was like, wow. I didn't even have to, like, ask. I just kind of threw it out there and boated the bass. All right. So kudos on that, guys. And the fact that you have been selected as part of the production team for the Investigation Discovery follow-up to Joe Exotic, the Tiger's Lies and Cover-Up going on there. Yeah, like, that is fantastically done and produced as well. So you guys are in the thick of this stuff day in, day out. And that's what I love about you.
Projects, you know, I mean, we just, and somehow we always be involved with them. So it's fun, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Well,
yeah, when I got that call, I was still pretty surprised. It's, you know, it's a work in progress still, so we're really limited on anything we can say about it. But it has, the first three episodes have come out.
Yeah, I haven't watched the third one yet.
Discovery, and they're just really interesting.
Oh, man, the first two are like, if you enjoy Joe Exotic at all, folks, any part of that story arc at all, you've got to watch this show. Like, hands down, there is nothing flash and trash, just like clickbait about it. Like, this is the meat right here. Like, you could have really probably summed up the whole Joe Exotic thing in a trilogy of hour-long shows instead of a whole season. But
right. Well, what this one does is it delves into where the story kind of drops off with the Carol Baskin and Joe Exotic thing. So that's where it kind of goes into and it answers a lot of questions that were left off in the series. So it goes a little bit further into the investigation side where the series is more, you know, borderline bizarre entertainment, but other than that, it's very interesting. I can tell you that because I had not even seen an episode of Tiger King until about 4 weeks ago.
about
4 or 5 weeks ago.
It ruined everybody's weekend, right? Because, or like ruined their work day, right? Because you sat down to watch it. I know so many people have this story. It's like, okay, I'm just going to watch one episode.
Yeah.
And then it's 7 hours later, you're still there watching it.
Yeah.
And you can't take your app. Like, I know so many people, like, darn it, I was supposed to do all these things today.
Yeah, it really.
It's like the potato chip of the docuseries. You can't just have one. You've got to just binge on that thing. It's just awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's awesome.
And the ID follow-up that you guys are doing for Investigation Discovery is phenomenal, man. It's been really, really well done. So kudos to you guys on that as well. Let's start cracking
that's
the
all
nut.
That's all the master editing over there. That's Ramsey. He can take
He's
things
great,
and just
man.
Piece them together and weave them into a story that otherwise you wouldn't think could go together. And he makes it into the magic that he does. And then when it comes out, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, there's some scenes that I saw, and I was like, wow.
I was one of three editors on the show, and, you know, so are we a team?
And the thing is, just to stay on that point for a minute, like, The only bad review that I have seen online, and I wouldn't even call it a bad review. It was just like, it was a review that after watching the show, when I saw it, I was like, was this dude watching the same movie? And it was from RogerEbert.com. I forget who the guy was, but it was like, you know, kind of strays. And I'm like, I don't think so.
It wasn't Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert's dead. It was somebody but they're still using that Roger Ebert name, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, if Roger Ebert didn't like my movie, I'd be bummed out. But who the hell is this guy anyway?
That's
the question you have to ask yourself with critics. It's like, okay, I mean, you know, these critics who like criticize a movie, give them a camera and give the filmmaker a camera and see who makes the better one.
Let's go toe to toe, guy.
Brian Tallarico or something.
It's like he's at a bowling alley watching the next lane and not understanding why he's not getting strikes and stuff. It's like, you know, dude, you I don't know what you're watching, but this is pretty well put together.
I watch a ton of documentary and a ton of investigative journalism for this show, guys. And I'm here to tell you, Ramsey, you have one of the best storytelling styles around when it comes to material like this. You have really taken the events of 1 October and the utter aftermath of a year after that. And really enveloped it into a coherent story that somebody who, unlike us, you know, like you were in the thick of it, Mike, I was in the thick of it covering it here. I want to say that topic ranges back to like Dudes and Beer episode 128, and we're in 290, you know? That's how far back it goes. Like this is 3 years, you know? So to know that so much has gone on since then, but you have been able to keep track of it, find it, and been able to actively show it to the world in this way, I think really lays out the storyline for people in a way that was intended to be forgotten.
Right.
No, and the story still goes on, you know, but go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, that was the whole premise of Money Machines, that Vegas had to sweep this aside as fast as possible to get the registers ringing again. And that's what happened, you know. And the sad part of that is that a lot of the survivors have been forgotten, you know, and a lot of the trauma they've suffered. And it's just like, you know, Vegas doesn't really care about them. They occasionally make an effort, like once a year for a couple hours, maybe, to acknowledge them and talk about them, but they don't. But it's really just corporations paying lip service, and they don't mean a lick of it, in my opinion. It had to go away, and they did it, and they used their tremendous power and money to do so, and that's basically what Money Machine's about.
Let's start getting into that a little bit. Let's start breaking down the timeline of things that happened that night, and go into a little bit of Stephen Paddock, the man in question, because you guys have probably, next to his brother and family, the most unadulterated view of Stephen Paddock, more than anyone else. Like, y'all got exclusive interviews with Eric when he did, like, maybe one or two at the beginning that were very short. And then when they didn't actually cover the truth or anything, he was like, no, I'm not talking anymore.
And that was the thing, is like, we were trying to get at the truth of why this happened. Okay. Which is quite different from MGM's version of why it happened. And I remember when it came out, what was it called? Like A Killer on 432 or something.
Remember that? The ABC special.
The ABC special, and it was just like, just this, I mean, glib, MGM's wonderful, I don't know if you can call it a documentary, but it didn't really do it. I mean, like, at no point did it acknowledge that, you know, MGM had over 200 cameras out that night. At no point did it acknowledge that, like, Steve Paddock's discontent with MGM Resorts International is why this happened. And it was just this, and a lot of that is because MGM clearly had a hand in the editing and restricted their access.
Sure.
And so, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we do documentaries like this that aren't, you know, don't have, it's because MGM is interested in pushing their agenda and that, you know, there's a lot of money on the line. And so they had to make it look like they weren't legally liable for this. But the truth is, there's a lot of failures on their part that caused this to happen. And that's what Money Machine goes into.
Yeah. And what was it that brought you into helping produce this, Mike? Because I know the whole reason you came onto this show in the first place was thanks to our good friend and listener, Shannon Caffey.
Exactly.
Because of him.
It actually was. If I wouldn't have met up with Shannon and his wife Andrea, I would not. And I do want to put thoughts and prayers out for them as well. They're going through some stuff right now. But
yeah.
But Shannon, I met Shannon and Andrea at the venue. Within 40 minutes of them taking down the last rung of tape. You know, from that one side where the parking lot was, and I was first person to literally walk into that section, and then I met up with Shannon and Andrea, and then Laura Loomer came by, and me and her were walking the grounds, and we started talking to Shannon and Andrea, and then they walked us over to where Melissa Ramirez's memorial was, and so that got pretty much that ball rolling there. And while I was there with you know, it was all four of us. You know, that's when I looked up on the wall and I saw the camera, and then the rest is history. You just kind of, went and got that footage. And then I met up with Ramsey. Like I said, I first met him at the 6 months anniversary, but we had talked a couple times, and in our talks, it was just, you know, just getting a feel for what I could probably do for him when I knew he was making the documentary. In my mind, I'm saying, you know what,
sure.
I can probably help him out too, as best I can, you know, so that got that ball rolling.
Well,
yeah, I think Shannon was there when we met. I remember one of the first meetings we had was when we were actually looking at the bullet holes that night by Melissa Ramirez's. And, you know, and like I want to take a second to talk about Shannon first.
Yeah,
so Shannon's just
please.
Like the most like amiable, likable guy ever. Just
absolutely.
Yeah, he is.
Just guy. You know, so I think, you know, and so, I mean, yeah, so I think it was Shannon that kind of like helped bring us together just because we both knew Shannon. If you know Shannon,
exactly.
Obviously,
yeah,
because he's Shannon.
You can, so, yeah,
absolutely,
I mean,
the
you
most
can't...
genuine, sincere, lovable person that you'll
yeah,
ever meet. Just absolutely, just phenomenal guy.
Yeah, and shout out to T-shirt Toad. He and his wife's company. Mm-hmm. They provided some great shirts for the network. So thank you guys. And it, you know, it really is interesting, even the way, like I said, that we have come to be together and working on this in the same way to try and expose this and bring it out to the public. I have done my best to keep the story of what happened on October 1st alive and to try and keep it in people's minds. Like, we literally had, oh my God, what was... I'm trying to remember. It was like 1,100 shots. There were 861 people wounded and 58 dead. So, yeah, like
60 now. Total 60 after the.
That's right.
You know, we had two more. Sheriff Lombardo added two more last week. Officially, everybody knew it was up to 60, but he finally gave it an official number. So
that's nice.
And that yeah, it was.
And you know, that's just it, to know that this story was glazed over so fast. It happened right on the heels of Pulse.
Yep.
You know, and that was a big, big heated thing when it happened. San Bernardino. There were a few major shootings that happened that year. But when this happened, it was literally... attempt to, like you were saying earlier, Ram, and like the documentary says, swept under the rug so fast to literally get back to business as normal. There's a security guard, or not a security guard, a former LVPD member in the documentary who's quoted saying that, you know, everything in Vegas goes by the ring of a register, you know? And it was, how fast can we get back to business as usual? The last thing we can do is have people think that Vegas is unsafe to come visit.
Like, right.
They bring in the gross income of small nations in a month, folks. And at one point, y'all actually show on screen what is the total income for?
I remember the statistic. It was like, and that was a UNLV gaming study. I think it said that like the graphic that we have in there, like that the average casino in Vegas, the average strip casino makes over $300,000 a day. I believe the statistic was something about that. So you know, you have all those properties on the strip.
Yeah,
and so I mean, if you just imagine a big register that's just spitting out money all day long.
Well, and that's what my wife said when we were watching when we were watching the show the first time. That's what my wife said, was like, "Oh my God, did it just say that Mandalay Bay made over $250,000 a day?" And I was like, "No, it said every casino on the strip makes over $250,000 a day." She was like,
"Well, you can imagine that they probably average that out. The bigger ones even probably do more. I could see, you know, an MGM doing $500,000, you know, Mandalay Bay doing $350,000, well, you know,
especially,
that kind of stuff."
Especially once you take into consideration the fact that there is an event property attached to every one of these where people like me are employed doing conferences. And that's let's start kind of getting into some of the security now, talking about that, because one of the things I brought up on this show regularly whenever we talked about this was I traveled to Vegas annually to a show abutting SHOT Show, and that is one of the biggest arms sales events in the world. That's like a CES for riflery and handguns.
Used to do that show every year. Sure did.
And literally, like, you see people going down the public elevator with their rifle cases, going to their booth. You know, like, it was no big thing. So for me, whenever I heard that, like, this guy ended up in his hotel room with a whole bunch of guns, I was like, okay, was it near SHOT Show? Like, like, that's,
I always had weapons in my hotel room. Never even thought anything about it. It's just your most expensive stuff. You pretty much brought back to the room.
You didn't leave it at the booth.
The truth is that most people with guns are responsible with their guns, you know, and even if, you know, and like,
absolutely.
The other thing I want to say is, like, I mean, Chris, you know how this is, like, you know, hauling a, I don't know. I probably stayed in Vegas at least 50, 60 times and hauled up all my equipment up to those rooms. And, and you know, those tripod cases and stuff look a lot like gun cases.
Yeah.
And nobody ever,
not a question.
People just look the other way. It's kind of the norm. So,
well, and that's just like, it. That
people were shocked, you know,
it sounds,
why he was able to get all those guns up there. Those sound like people who haven't actually been to Las Vegas.
Well, yeah, precisely. And it really is one of those things of, when this is the kind of thing that's the norm, to have conferences like that floating around your city 2, 3, 4, 5 times a year, you know.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Paddock, too, is the way he brought him to the room, obviously through the service elevators primarily, but the suitcases that he was bringing were not like long rifle cases. All the weapons that he brought were takedown type weapons where he had to basically assemble them in the room. So
they all had bump stocks on them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So they were chopped to begin with and easy to put into regular baggage, that kind of stuff. And even then, whenever you're going, you know, like you were saying, through the private elevators, you've been through those elevators. I know I travel up and down the service corridors all the time in hotels. If you're wearing black, carrying a roll of tape and walk with authority, they probably won't question you, folks.
This is true.
But let's get into a little bit of that, because this is one of the things that kind of brought you guys together. Like we were saying, the three of us were really covering this thing from totally different angles and totally different perspectives this whole time. And to see the way that once, because of course Ram had done What Happened in Vegas, which was another phenomenal documentary on the corruption of the Las Vegas Police Department. And that was right on the heels of starting this. So, like, he started covering this in that angle. You started covering this from the angle of, wait a minute, how did he get things up there? You know, and started literally on the ground, foot traffic infiltrating the place.
Literally.
When you're making a film, you need somebody who has the skills that you don't have, you know? And absolutely, that's, I think, why Mike and I work well together. It's like, is that our skills complement each other.
Exactly.
The worst thing that you can have is somebody is two people with like a dual set of skills, you know?
Yeah,
like,
and then you're almost stepping over each other.
I wouldn't trust myself to fly a drone for 6 inches.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
I had a $30 one that ended up on the roof of a hotel in Washington, so I'm all good, bro.
So you know, there's things I can't do that Mike can, and you know, so it worked out well.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it does. It was like pieces of a puzzle. It was, you know, everything he was kind of, I don't want to say lacking in, because both of us could do some of the others, but not like the other, you know. So it was like,
yeah
I can go and do this. And it was just such a complimentary type relationship. It just worked. And I know the first time I went out there, he's calling me like every 10-15 minutes. Okay, you got to do this, go do it. And then after the first trip I came back, he's like, just go do what you do, man. I trust you, man. Just go get the film.
But the thing with Mike too is you're always going, how did you find that out?
Well, that happens.
I just verified that that's true, but how did you know that?
Yeah, and quite honestly, also it's the fact of Mike is just one of those people that when he sees something, he's just going to doggedly go after it.
Yep.
Like he's like a dog with a bone, dude.
To be found, I'm just going to point my sights and just.
Yeah.
If I know something's there, I'm just going to go get it. Just like the elevators, just like the glass, which is one of the first things I did, and which is, you know, kind of minor on the overall scheme of things. But when it comes down to some of the internal stuff that you know, one of the first questions asked, it was really simple, and it seemed like it'd be more complex than it was. But, you know, you had Craig Island, who's an attorney who worked under his own umbrella, and he was on Fox, and he literally just said, you know, we don't know how he got those weapons up there. We don't know if he needed a key, if he needed a, you know, or whatever. I said, well, there's my first question. Let me go answer that.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, precisely.
Next thing you know, we're on Fox News.
Well, and, you know, to go through now, to start looking at everything in such a critical light, like we said, the entire time, the office of Sheriff Lombardo out there was obfuscating information, was keeping information away from the media. Come the end of the first year, they were actively being sued by the media for not releasing public documents.
Yep, yeah, and they still haven't.
Yeah, they still haven't. As a matter of fact, they were trying to charge money to the media for documents that should be publicly available.
Yep, half a million bucks.
Public funds, because remember the LVMPD is funded by the public.
That's
to actually hire lawyers to prevent the release of the body cam footage and calls. Wow. And I mean, that stuff's public information. So, doing this because for a very simple reason, it was an election year and he didn't need all this footage coming out showing how incompetent LVMPD actually was that night. And so he used public. And so these are the reasons why I'm so hard on this guy, because he's a fundamentally dishonest individual, and he has, and he's fundamentally selfish. And I think the way he handled 1 October is a good example of that. And we just can't have public officials that we're paying behave like this clown, you know?
When he finally did put the information out, he put it out in a certain order. I mean, the body cam footage came out in certain order. Officer Hendricks freezing up in the hallway.
Yep.
That didn't come out till after the election.
Yeah.
John O'Donnell having his weapon discharged in room 134, 135 during the breach to the second room.
Yep.
That didn't come out till after the election. So that was all coordinated.
Was that before or after the election? The reveal that the body had been moved. I'm trying to remember.
The reveal that the body had been moved, I started hearing rumblings of that from retired LVMPD cops early on. And I got a lot of my information. I believe it was the same LVMPD cop who told me that there was an accidental discharge in Paddock's room that Lombardo conveniently didn't mention. So I started hearing rumblings of that stuff. And then, of course, when the body cam footage came out, it verified that.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
yeah, so it definitely was a coordinated effort of getting all that information out and timing it and stuff like this. And to this day, there's still, you know, there's supposed to be 750 hours of video. We've gotten, I think, 400 and something hours, and, you know, in documents that it was weird because they said, oh, there's all the documents. And then the next thing you know, they make a phone call on that classic Wednesday, every Wednesday morning, you know, saying, oh, we found some more stuff, you know, so they actually put it out there. But some of the officer statements, it's like, we didn't get Officer Matsko's statement until well after the fact. And his statement is the one that verified that they moved Paddock's body.
Yeah.
And that where the pictures were taken there, who took the leaked image pictures. Now, who actually leaked them is maybe another story, but the person who took the pictures was guaranteed 100% Hancock.
Yeah. So,
you know, and those are things you have to look back on. You wonder, okay, well, who's running the show? Who's pulling the strings? Who's the master of the puppets? You know, all of these different things. And it's MGM. And then when you get down to the end of the case and you start realizing, oh, wow, here's the proof that all that was coordinated. You got George Togliatti, the father of Jennifer Togliatti. Who's the mediation judge? Wow. Yeah. Okay. It's all coming together now. All the pieces of the puzzle are starting to fit.
Yeah, and that's just it. Like, it is, and it's been a slow simmer, a slow boil, literally the boil the frog concept, where it's just slowly turn up the heat, the way that this information's come out. Because, yeah, the fact that we had you on not too long ago talking about the fact that it's just recently come out that the mediator and MGM are connected.
Right.
All that kind of stuff.
Astounding to me. Like they see, one of the things that I am still kind of surprised by is that they think they can just pull this stuff, that they can just do things like this in broad daylight and not be called out on it. Like, that you would think that, I mean, here George Togliatti is, you know, the former vice president of security at MGM Resorts International. And then his daughter, Jennifer Togliatti, is the mediator. And they just think that nobody's gonna.
Yeah, nobody's gonna cue in on that ever, you know.
Well, and that's just one of those things you instantly recuse yourself. I mean, you walk out the door and you go, "Sorry, guys, my dad is the vice president of MGM, head of security, safety, and surveillance. Oh, and by the way, he was also an FBI agent for 23 years and ran the organized crime division here in Las Vegas. I mean, come on."
Well, I mean, though, I mean, not even to get political, but even our next debate is headed by somebody that was a former intern of one of the candidates. So it's like, wait a minute. If that dude couldn't sit on a trial for that guy, how come he's allowed to ask him questions to be to be president?
That makes a lot of sense.
Shouldn't that be as separate a process as possible? Like, you have no 18th connection to this guy. Like,
writing the script for this thing, and they're going, no one's going to believe this shit, so let's just do some really outlandish things here. It's like, there you go.
And I also think that's what you have in Vegas is, like, but I think what allows that to happen is that you don't really have a real media in Vegas.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, you don't, you have you know, I can't think of any other major city with a more complacent and asleep at the wheel media and a media that serves the big money more than the one you have in Vegas. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I can imagine. I mean,
you would think there would be a flurry of stories about this, you know?
Yeah.
And there just aren't, you know, it's just, they're controlled by the money too.
Well,
you know?
and that's just it. Our society has really gotten to a point where our media really pushes more of a paradigm than it is being curious. And that's dangerous. You know, that's when it starts getting dangerous.
In the very beginning, they were almost okay. And, like, right when the shooting happened, it seemed like the media was on board.
They were on.
It really did. And then it just dropped to nothing once they realized, oh, it's time to get back to business.
Well, you know, it was back to business, and it was the fact of, right, as we went back to business, we got hashtag Vegas Strong going. We got a nice funding campaign going, so we'll mention the thing, but we'll just mention hashtag Vegas Strong at the end of the broadcast every night.
And that's a good point. At first, it served their interests.
Exactly.
Right? So when it served Sheriff Lombardo and his buddy Sisolak's interests, Vegas Strong, you know, and that's one of the things we go into the movie too, is like, so this happens, this event happens, and then, like, the next morning, They have this Vegas Strong thing.
Yeah,
and,
there's this whole campaign to roll out.
To go. And you've got Steve Sisolak, who's at the time a lowly county commissioner, like wanting to become governor. And this guy, this county, I mean, can you think of any other case where you've seen a county commissioner in like national press conferences when the sheriff's talking?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is this guy doing in the background?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Don't you collect,
positioning himself?
Don't you collect property taxes?
What's that?
Like, don't you collect property taxes? What are you here talking about a crime for? You know?
Yeah. It became just this dog pony show and so when it served Sheriff Lombardo, when it served their interests in the whole Vegas Strong con, then they were. But as soon as it stopped serving their interests, as soon as the story started to churn, as soon as their incompetence started to be exposed, you saw that they cut off those press conferences and they were never coming back.
Oh, it's literally my favorite end to a press conference ever is Sheriff Lombardo. Like, it's the class. I'm sorry, that's not how we run things here.
You
need to stop asking your question right now. That's the last thing we do at a press conference is allow y'all to ask questions. You hear?
Yeah. You stop asking your questions.
And it's like the chutzpah. Oh, my God. But literally, that was his response, was you need to stop asking your question. That's not how we do things here.
Smoothie, Sheriff Lombardo, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember, like I said, having you on just as he was being reelected. And we were hoping to God that he wouldn't be, but sadly, it's the fact of sheriff is one of those things that whenever people go in to vote, it's one of the only names they know. Is like, oh yeah, I remember my sheriff's
name.
Over
$1 million, and the next closest candidate had less than 100,000.
Yeah,
so when you have
that too,
more than 12 times the money, then it's not going to be hard to get elected when you. And people say, it was rigged. It wasn't rigged. You don't need to rig an election when you have over $1 million and you're and
right.
the only other candidate has like around 80.
Well, then that was the rigging. The casinos funneling all that money into him in roundabout ways. And then him hiding his property, him giving his houses and stuff to his daughter and the neighbor and the neighbor's dog and, you know, whatever he was doing with the houses. And then they, gifting them pretty much. I think one went for a dollar. That was just ridiculous.
I know
he wasn't thrilled with me. Lombardo wasn't thrilled for me when I put out that video.
Oh, yeah. No, he wasn't. He wasn't. I should have downloaded
that. He actually called up and actually somebody told me that he really flipped out on that one.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes left with you, Ram, before we have to let you go. We can absolutely carry on with Mike, which I kind of intend to do for a little while.
Then go into the rest with him. I'll sit in the background here.
But before we let you go, Ram, let's start getting into some of these details, because Sheriff Lombardo wasn't the only one giving property away. There was a wounded security guard at one point that was supposed to do a whole lot of appearing on TV. That famously went on the Ellen DeGeneres show. That was the one person that got a show. And I love the fact that they went like straight up CSI and like brought out like, oh yeah, here's some printouts of the overhead of the room. So it was right here, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like total forensic lab.
Ellen was just like died in the story, and no journalism came within 8 miles of that interview.
No,
it was just it was just a blatant, flat out like puff piece.
It
was like, oh, MGM's wonderful and you're great and you're a hero and MGM's great and
and she wasn't connected to MGM at all.
No, they're written like 18 banks of Ellen show, gambling machines in there, there's probably 23 banks of them in there now, but and that's
the Yankton when their popularity started to go downhill. Money never really about anything other than that in Vegas, but
it really does come to bear though. Let's start getting into, of course, what people have asked, what people have wondered. Second shooter is one of the first things that comes to mind. As I sat and watched the documentary the first time, I absorbed it. As I watched it the second time, I got critical and took notes for tonight. So that is, of course, one of the hot button topics whenever, aside from deniers, let's address that right now, because we've had them not only in the Dudes and Beer group, we have had them, I know you've had them, Mike, I know you've had them, Ram, and we've all confronted them.
Boy.
Did this thing happen? Was this a bunch of crisis actors? Was this a false flag and a bunch of crisis actors?
This is actually
actors?
Why Ramsey brought me on board, if you want to know the truth.
I know.
That's why I came on. Yeah, definitely.
I know. But we got to answer the question. Like, that's what the show's about, the hard questions. And I even floated my theory, and I've told it to you numerous times. Mike, I'll tell it to you, Ramsey, and again to the audience. And that is that at one point, the good Mr. Paddock was an accountant for Lockheed Martin. So I posit the fact that he actively wanted to expose Skunk Works and what they do at the Janet facilities, things like that. And that is why his first round was shot at the gas tanks over by McCarran. That's just my crazy theory. That's out there. But that is not the fact, people. That's not the fact. That's just my crazy opinion, all right? There are facts to this. So let's start going into this. The fact that how many shooters were there? How did all of this come about? How did it actively go down? Just so people don't get it twisted.
At first, I really thought there were multiple shooters. I did, because when I talked to the people who were there that night, they would tell you. You know, when I talked to the first five or six people I talked to who were there that night, I said, you know, and they'd say, I think there are multiple shooters. And I'd say, well, did you see any? And they said, well, no. But every time, you know, I felt like I was running away from the gunfire. I never felt like I could get away with it because it was always loud and it was just no matter where we went. And so they you know, very understandably felt like they were constantly being pursued. And it's an understandable thing. But then when we, really delved into the forensic, you know, so the truth is I didn't know, and we were trying to find out if there were multiple shooters. And then, you know, what really changed my mind for good was when I, you know, I went out to Montana and interviewed one of the foremost forensic audio analysts in the U.S., Dr. Rob Maher, who's, you know, has a, you know, written books on forensic audio and is testified in courts. And
beautiful interview. You know,
yeah, and he really kind of analyzed the waveforms and pointed out some very astute things and gave his expert opinion, and then it was also, you know, that basically that there wasn't multiple shooters. That if you look at a waveform of the gunshots, there's not overlapping gunfire, and there's not all these things, you know.
Yeah,
and then Mike was actually brought up a very interesting point early on as well, basically that. If there were multiple shooters and you're wanting to inflict maximum carnage, then why were there pauses between the volleys? Right? Because, you know, those 12, 13, 14 volleys, whichever amount there were, if you listen to those, Mike, was it what, 11, 12 minutes of firing? It was somewhere between there, right?
Yeah.
About almost 15 or, you know, 11 minutes, you know, of continuous. But yeah, you're right. That was one of those aha moments when I told Ramsey, I said, think about the logic of this. If you've got multiple shooters, why would they stop? They're not going to be firing in, you know, in sync with each other. They're going to be firing off sync.
That's right.
And there wouldn't be a lull between the volleys. And he went, you know, Ramsey, that makes sense. And then from, I think between that and the audio analysis and everything, the rest was, you know, every time somebody said there was another shooter, we were just like, man, we can't be distracted by this stuff anymore.
Yeah. No, no. And that's just it. At some point, you really do have to start focusing in on what you're trying to do, because it becomes, and that's one reason why, you know, police departments, in the case of things like the Zodiac Killer, that kind of stuff,
right.
Hold things back from the public, A, to avoid any kind of copycat, B, to weed out fact from fiction. But that is not the case in this, folks. That is not the case of what happened here with October 1 and with the Mandalay Bay Massacre. Like, this is totally different.
Kind of agenda to say there wasn't multiple shooters, and the answer to that is
he came out within 12 hours within at the first press conference. That was one of the things that he straight up addressed at the beginning. I just want to make it clear, there's only one shooter here and he's dead.
Yep.
First thing out of his mouth, it's like, But you're saying you're doing a full investigation. This is not even 12 hours later.
Right.
Yep. And that was the Aaron Rouse thing there that was whispered in his ear, because he had to calm the public down because so many conspiracy theories started right away.
Yeah.
With all this, you know, they're up, running up and down the street and going into these other hotels. And of course, if you run into the Bellagio and you just ran a half a mile down the street, you run into the Bellagio, yeah, you got blood all over you. And someone says, "What happened?" And he says, "There's a shooting."
There's a shooting.
Well, next thing you know, someone's in the Bellagio on the phone calling 911 mm-hmm. saying there's a shooting at the Bellagio.
That's right. All they know is bloody person in the Bellagio. And even the witness, oh my God, I cannot even remember her name. All I remember is the pumpkin description.
Renee Downs.
Oh, good Lord, folks. That was a heart-wrenching moment just to hear the recount of that. But to hear her recount literally the words of the casino manager who came up to her and was like, "Ma'am, you've obviously had too much to drink. I think you need to just go up to your room and lay down." And it's like, she is covered with blood and brain material right now.
Yeah, that was Catherine Thornton. Yeah, that was her.
That was wild to me. And so, I thought that interview, and that's why we had so much of her interview in that thing, is because that was kind of the thesis of the whole movie, is that there's this horrible thing happening, there's blood on her face, and yet everybody's like ignoring it. Just go back up to your room and relax, and I'll be okay.
Yep. No, if that isn't the telltale
on herself and wine.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you got tapioca all over you, ma'am. Would you like another free, you know, like boba tea? The obliviousness of that and the rote, it takes a certain rote memorization of SOP for that to be the response to somebody. Not, "Ma'am, do you need help?" Like, it takes a certain mechanical standard operating procedure to be drilled into somebody for the first reaction to be, "Please go upstairs and go back to sleep. You're covered in blood and scaring people."
That or the guy's a robot.
And please stop upsetting people that
either
are putting
that
money on the table.
They've got amazing AI.
They could be a robot. I mean, because a robot would act like
that. And that's just it. Like, what an inhumane thought to begin with. Not like, "My God, ma'am, do you need, obviously you need help." Like, this is the situation I tell people all the time of Smooth Criminal, where it's like, "Dude, you heard that Annie got smacked. You saw it." "You were the worst first responder ever, Michael Jackson." No, Annie's not okay. She's not okay. Go get help. You know, like, same exact situation. Like, "Hey, Mr. Casino Manager, there's somebody covered in blood. You may want to get some help." Instead, it's how fast can we get you out of the public eye?
I never thought about Smooth Criminal like that. That's interesting. Like, you're going to get distracted by all the, like, the shaking.
No, you saw a crime go down and you told nobody, bro. I make that joke on site all the time whenever I hear it play on Muzak in the background, like, "Michael Jackson, worst first responder ever."
But he can lean over and look over the side if he needed to see if somebody went off a cliff or something. That was pretty good.
And, you know, really, you have to stop and think about it, because I worked in casinos for a little while in Louisiana. It's nowhere near what it is in Vegas, but you definitely do kind of get this malaise over you. That comes over you the same way that the players do, where they're kind of entranced, you know.
You used to work for a guy that would do that to 100,000 people at a time. I won't mention names.
Anyway, Ramsey, go ahead there.
Oh, man.
Go ahead, Ramsey.
Oh, no. No, that's it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, you know, Michael Jackson. Yeah. Annie, are you okay?
Are you okay, Annie?
Why are you, are you asking?
Dude, she's not moving, bro. Go get help.
Help Annie. You've got to help Annie.
And the thing is she's traumatized for life from this. And, and I know, you know, we're talking now, I'm sure some people listening will think that, you know, we're making light of everything. But, you know, kind of at this point, we're kind of, you know,
into the part where it really is so serious that you almost have to just look at it and go, this was so bizarre and so crazy and so many things happened in this investigation that it should have been in the limelight the entire 3 years.
It should still be in the limelight. Like, the settlement just came through, like, all of 7 or 8 months ago.
Yeah, and in the meantime, the money won't come in until January now, we're still waiting on everything. So.
And the fact is, like, in the meantime, we've had MGM at one point level charges, not necessarily charges, but lawsuit against the victims to say, costless lawsuit, like, we don't want money from you, but you can't sue us.
They were suing anywhere from 6 years old up to 96 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, just and everywhere in between from that. And that just is absolutely absurd.
That's crazy.
Again, smooth smoothies, huh?
Yeah.
Like, geez.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Ram, I know you have to actually get going this evening, unfortunately. So we're going to go ahead and let you hop off. Please, before you go, though, let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of Money Machine.
Money Machine is on iTunes and Amazon and Google Play and the other VOD platforms. And you can, it came out on October 1st, and you can check out the movie now. And, and also follow us on our Facebook page. Just go to Money Machine, type in Money Machine movie, and you'll find it and follow us. You know, we have a lot of updates. You know, there's still new information coming out, believe it or not.
Oh, no, so, constantly.
Mike's kind of in the center of it. And so, we are, if you're interested in this case, follow us because we're, even though the movie's out already, we're still tracking it.
Oh, I guarantee you that within 2 years, there will be at a minimum a 1 hour follow up just with the stuff that keeps coming out.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just
like the bump stock manufacturer suing, the victims fund.
Yeah.
I mean, what thought process does a person have to go? You invented the item that actually caused or helped cause maximum carnage at the largest mass shooting in U.S. history, and you're the inventor of this thing. And then to throw injury to insult, you're going to sue the victims fund, the money that's going to go to the victims from the person that caused this using your product. Who wakes up in the morning and says, that sounds like a great idea?
Granted, our original guest, Michael Cargill, the owner of Central Texas Gunworks, actively sued the federal government. We've had him on the show to talk about it. Actively sued the federal government over the loss of his bump stock inventory because of this.
Right. Yep.
He was the first gun store owner in the country to say, "Hey, federal government, if you're going to make what I'm selling suddenly illegal and tell me I have to turn it in, you at least have to compensate for the stock."
That's right.
Because when I bought it, it was legal. You just made it illegal, and now you're confiscating all of them. So yeah, that was landmark even. And there have been so many little landmark moments like that have come about because of this literally hidden story now. And to know that this was so and still is so swept under the rug, even to go on the other night and watch some of the live coverage, quote, live coverage from Las Vegas media was sad. It was saddening. True. Like you were saying, Ram, it is not true journalism. It is not true reporting. They were not covering a story. They should have been going over the fact that this thing is still open.
Yeah, true. And there's nowhere else on the planet where the memorial, and I know some people disagree with my thoughts on this, but there's nowhere I have ever been that the memorial for the very event is 7 miles away from where the event happened. That only in Vegas would they take something so far and so extreme to push it under the rug, to take the memorial and put it 7 miles away, out of sight, out of mind.
Oh, not only that, but to donate the property that it happened on to the police department that was at fault for letting it happen and covering it up.
Yeah, well, luckily that one didn't go through, but they had already mentioned they were going to do that.
Oh, they were ready.
Now it's going to be a parking lot.
They were ready.
But, yeah.
So,
yes, they were.
Ram, I'm going to go ahead and let you go, my friend. I know that you have things to go do in the studio, things like that. So go make that amazing, beautiful art that you do, like the new Joe Exotic stuff on Investigation Discovery, as well as this amazing documentary, Money Machine. Thank you so much for everything that you have done to keep this story in the headlight of America and to keep this truth coming out, Ram. Oh, is Ram already gone?
And maybe so. Well, Ram, if you can hear me, thank you for being such a good friend, buddy. I absolutely appreciate everything you've done for me and also, you know, us, you know, getting together and putting this together and for all of time and history. So that's just an awesome thing. And I appreciate putting that in it. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much, Ram. Mike, let's carry on for a minute or two because there are so many things to get into. Sure. I mean, you know me, I'm conspiratorial at heart. My brain is willing to go down numerous rabbit holes at the same time. But this is one of those things.
I'm converting you 8 ounces at a time.
That's right. you got to be well lubricated to slide down those rabbit holes, folks.
Hey, don't mention lubrication to me right now.
Well, wow. So I know anyway, awkward, Mike. To start going into things, like I said, that I mean, whenever I first had you on and things were still open in the case, the FBI had not dusted their hands of it. The LVPD had not dusted their hands of it yet. The theory that I put out earlier was what I held. At least as of now, that's what we knew. That's what I held. Why shoot at the tank? You know,
the first thing I thought of with the tanks was that was the first thing he was shooting at. And I was, you know, it's very hard for an investigator to come out and say, I was dead wrong on that one.
Yeah,
I was touting the first thing shooting at the tanks to get everybody to crowd back into the line of fire and things like that. But no, he that wasn't it. So, he didn't shoot at them until 4 or 5 minutes into that thing. So, or the, you know, fourth or fifth volley too. So that was just, you know, but when you figure things out, now the weird thing is that you've got someone, you know, myself and some other investigators that go into this thing and are able to find evidence mm-hmm. that the FBI and the LVMPD could not get.
Yeah.
Case in point. 6 out of the 8 shots fired out of the room 134, the FBI was able to figure out they went over towards the tanks because the Uber driver was sitting there. But the last 2 shots, nope, they have no clue when they were fired or where they went. And then the last shot, which was the suicide shot, killing himself, that shot, no one could figure out where it was. And here it is, somebody without any access to the evidence whatsoever is able to figure this out. And they've got 1,100 investigators working on this. And here's, you know, some YouTube guys out here actually able to put this stuff together. That, to me, is not only amazing, it just shows that people, us armchair investigators, can actually go out and do something and make a difference. And that's important. So you've got that going, you know, you've got people that listen to these things.
Yep.
They watch these events, they get on, they start talking about them, and they actually start solving crimes. Case in point, the Joe Exotic case, right?
Damn
down
right.
Here where I'm at right now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and even the fact that you guys, at the very beginning, all of the original coverage that came out was from Las Vegas Incidents. It was from a Facebook group.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
And it was because they had members on the ground, and I think even some of their admins that were there attending the concert that night when it went down, and they just started streaming.
They were streaming before the shots ended.
Yeah.
That's how on the ball they were that night. They were excellent.
And that's where a lot of the footage that we see, stuff like that, like the footage that we played at the beginning of the show, that kind of stuff, that mm-hmm. is where that came from. And that is the footage that we now know in infamy with this night. And like I said, to know that 60 people now is the official count. 60 people died that night. And if you look at the, if you watch the footage in this documentary, folks, and believe me, I tried to find overhead footage. I tried to find bird's eye footage of the concert.
Right.
It's in this it's some of the footage that y'all have in this documentary is literally mind numbing, Mike, because you said in the documentary, you have access to 7 a.m. to 12 midnight that night.
Absolutely. And it's actually 7 a.m. that day on October 1st all the way through midnight on the 3rd. So, and with all of that, you know, you sit here and you wonder, there's a lot of things you wonder, but one of the things that they said, a lot of people were thinking the FBI was taking people's cell phones and wiping their cell phones. Getting the phone back without video and stuff like this. One of the things people keep asking me is that, why didn't you give that evidence to the FBI? And I look at every time somebody asks me that question, why didn't you give your evidence to the FBI? Why'd you give it to a lawyer? Well, I gave it to a lawyer because if I would have given it to the FBI, you would have never seen it.
That's right.
Think about it. How many times have you seen the FBI come out and say, hey, we've got some new footage from the Las Vegas shooting? You know, nothing. We've never seen anything from them. So,
number one, yes, it would disappear into every archive in the world, just like all the other footage from the Boston bombing.
Yep.
All that kind of stuff. The fact that this was not labeled an event of domestic terrorism.
Yep.
Was amazing.
And that was one of the first things. Yeah, when they came out with that, when they were going to use the main thing for them to call it an act of domestic terrorism is so they could use the Safety Act. And since they could not, you had Sheriff Lombardo saying it was one thing, you had Aaron Rouse saying it was another. And the main thing was Department of Homeland Security, you know, they were the ones that had to come out and say it was an act of domestic terrorism, and they couldn't do it because it didn't fit the criteria.
Well,
and the
it wasn't done to advance a political means. Like, that's literally the definition of terrorism, domestic or abroad. Yeah, it's got to be done for some kind of political end.
Yeah, political, religious, or you have to have some sort of organized reason for them to do it, or some ideology that's behind it. And because they didn't have that, then that basically removed it completely from it. But guess what? Department of Homeland Security has one of those definitions pulled. So they could have, you know, used that definition if they really wanted to press it. But in the end, they did the right thing. They didn't call it active domestic terrorism. That was the first thing. I got on the phone and talked to Catherine Lombardo. And that post is still on her page to this day. May she rest in peace.
Yeah.
Is me telling her, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. And here's why. And then I got on the phone with her and explained to her the deep details about it. And that's the next day. They were in there arguing left and right. I was actually down the hall a little bit and got to see over here. She was one feisty woman. She was an amazing.
Oh, she was fighting, man.
Yeah.
She was fighting.
Oh, my God.
And when she died, man, that was right as we hooked up. For this show.
I'm going to tell you my Catherine Lombardo story. Now that everything's out, I'll tell you my Catherine Lombardo story. One of them. When she was over, we were there for court one day, and I'd come in, and I was sitting in court with her, and then I moved over to the other side, and I was just, like, observing and stuff like this, and she always, like, valued my opinion on what, you know, what I saw in court. And then, so I leave, and I go back to the hotel, and they had another afternoon session that was just the attorneys, and they had an in-house media thing where they had a camera meeting with some other attorneys somewhere else. So I went back to the hotel. And as she left, she had her father with her. So as she left, she's driving out of town, and she calls me. She says, hey, I want to drop by there and just say hey to you before I go. And I said, okay, well, come on by. And if you got a minute, I'm on the 32nd floor. That's where my room is. If you want to come up and take a look at it. And of course, she hesitated for a second. I was like, I'm not coming on to you. I just wanted you to come up and see the room so you can see the view.
Yeah.
And she had never been up there. And that was the same. I think it was about a week or so around the time when they wanted to go into the room, but I actually called her and told her that they burned the carpet in the room and the whole rooms have been moved and it won't benefit you anyway. But so anyway, she came up, and as she walks into Mandalay Bay, we start walking towards the middle of the casino, which is where the main shaft elevators are. And I looked at her and I grabbed her hand real quick. I said, Catherine. She goes, what? I said, you want to go for a ride? She goes, no way. What? The service elevators? And she just stiff as a board, got nervous. And I said, come on, let's go have some fun.
So we go up the service elevators, and it was so cute. I mean, she's like 90 pounds, and she's just, you know, just standing in there just with her cell phone, you know, filming the walls and stuff, and it was a nervous wreck. And then we get out of the elevators, and we go in there and take a look out that 32nd room, 32nd floor. And it was surreal. I mean, just to stand there to watch her look out that window and to see, you know, all that that area, when you see it from the 32nd floor, for some reason, it just takes on a whole different perspective.
And for those of you out there that have never stayed in a room that high or in a building that high, especially with this kind of traffic around it, I told my wife just the other day, man, I miss it. And it was actually the first time that we watched this documentary. It started showing footage, and I was like, man, I miss Vegas. I miss Vegas. I miss going to Vegas. And it's this virus that did it, nothing else. It quite literally just such an energetic town. And when you stay somewhere, I've gotten to where I just, whenever I come out of my cab or my Uber or Lyft into my hotel, I've normally got like a $20 bill, and I slide it to the person at the front desk with my ID and ask him for a room with a nice view somewhere up high.
There you go.
Man, if you start getting up to like those 30th floors, stuff like that, like if you're watching our video loop here where you see the overhead view of the fountains and stuff, like I've had that view,
right?
You know, and dude, the vantage point of that, when you start looking at the rounds that he was able to get off, just start doing the math of almost 11 minutes of straight fire.
Yeah. Right. And he wasn't military trained.
Nope.
You know, he didn't have any specialized training really whatsoever, other than maybe buying a Davidson, you know, weapon, and then going out and, you know, spend $3,000 to $5,000. Someone's going to show you how to shoot it, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there's a couple of things that I never mentioned that I did mention to the attorneys. I'm trying to explain some of the reasoning for things. Everyone was wondering in the beginning, why couldn't he hit those damn tanks? If people were saying, oh, he was able to, you know, shoot people, blah, blah, blah. And,
that's,
you know,
literally
and
the broad side of a barn.
He hit the tank? Well, the magic of that is, number one, he wasn't shooting at the tanks.
Yeah.
He was shooting at an object very close to the tank to get that the gas to flow, or the jet fuel to flow in a certain way that would allow it to explode.
Yeah,
that was the primary thing, and I can say that now. The FAA told me in the very beginning when we were talking about some things that they didn't really want that mentioned, because they had to do things at these tanks to get them, those valves to change. But anyway, so that's what he was shooting at. But here's the reason why he even missed that. This is my opinion, but it's based on a lot of weapon history and stuff like that. I own a business called World of Weapons, and I was a firearms dealer. But as I sat in that room, I stayed in the room that was almost identical to room 134. It's the same rooms that me and Ramsey took the pictures and the images in. And the only way you could shoot out that window would be to lay across the bed. And if you lay across the bed with a 308 and you're trying to fire a 308, you're not going to have a steady hold, because the bed's going to move as you move. If you're laying on the floor or something like that with a pillow to prop you up, that's different. But you're laying on a bed that's definitely going to be moving around, and you're
Your breathing. So, the beds are typically nowhere near the windows in these places.
Well, in the room 134, they were. Literally, you could not sit down in a seating position and fire out that window without the barrel literally hanging out the window. But that's how close that side is. And I've got pictures, and I did a 360 degree view, and you can actually see it on my channel. But you know, those, I tried to mimic every position he was in to see. Yeah, you know, because people were showing, they would have drawings of him standing there, aiming out the window, and all these different locations. But in room 134, there's just no way you could do that.
Well, and also,
the only position was from.
Granted, like I said, you cannot publicly find a lot of this footage. But if you go through and watch this documentary, folks, there is a piece of footage that shows security camera footage from approximately that angle onto the property that was going on when the victim is describing And when the policeman, the former cop, is describing the fact of it was like shooting fish in a barrel, with the way that the people were packed in and the egress right. that they had, buddy, yeah, like you're lucky that the death toll was not higher. And if you start looking right. at the number of people wounded versus the number of rounds he put off, he hit one person for like every 2.3 rounds. Like,
right.
like he had a pretty good average, like out of 1,000 rounds to wound 800 people.
Yeah, when you look at that percentage-wise, if you walked into any location and said, "I'm
no
going
kudos to
position,
the murderer, folks."
Yeah, no, nothing like that at all. But you have to look at it from as non-empathetic as you can, I
That's
guess,
right.
just so you could get the actual information out. Is it from the position he was shooting in? If I would have went in somewhere and told even a Marine or I know Roger Keenis is listening to this and he's going to definitely critique what I'm about to say. Love you, man. But if you're on the 32nd floor and you're shooting down into a crowd,
you don't have to
be
a marksman.
Able to hit over 50% of your target.
You're not going
to.
I mean, you don't have to be a marksman.
No, you don't. But at the same time, to even in this situation, to be able to do that, it's still it is mind-boggling, and that also went towards people thinking there had to be multiple shooters because there's just no way one person could do all that. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. That's exactly what happened.
Fortunately, it was just one person.
You had one man that did it. Yeah, because we'd still be looking for the others.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, there were theories that abounded from the fact that it was the Saudi royal family, that the Saudi royal family was involved because, like, the Prince of Saudi Arabia has, like, an entire floor to himself at Mandalay or something like that. Right. Like, the theories about it, like I said, I mean, you heard mine more than once.
Yep, I did, and I had to just suck it up, and it's your show.
Well, hey, it's a theory. The thing is, you're allowed to float a theory.
And I know in the early throes of this, there were so many things coming out. The person I had probably the most issue with in the beginning was John Cullen. And with him saying the helicopter this and helicopter that and the problem and the thing is from the audio analysis we knew it wasn't that.
Well, and the Momo's saying it never happened.
His whole existence depended on the first 9 seconds of a video by a person. He didn't even know the name of the person that took the video. He didn't know the type of camera that was used to take the video. And I cornered him on that one day. I said, let's do a debate. He says, I'm not going to debate with you. You're mean and you're rude. I said, no, you're the one that's mean and rude because you're the one saying the helicopters are there killing people. And these people are calling me saying they don't even want to go to the grocery store when they hear a helicopter.
Yeah.
And that's the true story.
Yeah.
So I said, listen, your first 9 seconds of that video is not gunfire like you keep telling everybody. And then he does another video and he says, I found out that it's not gunfire. And then he says it's prop wash from the helicopter rotor blades. I'm like, it's not that either, buddy.
My favorite one was the guy.
Crazy.
My favorite one was the guy that was literally saying that it didn't happen.
Yeah.
In the video and recording himself. Talking about how it didn't happen, listening to you doing a report on how it happened, and then you start video bombing him from your truck as you start going around his house.
That's right. Don't do a lot. Don't call me out and then talk about my mom who just died an hour earlier.
Yeah.
And then call me out and not expect me to come to your house.
That
while
was
you're doing
classy,
your live show in your garage.
When you sent me that video of you like listen to the horn honks.
Yep.
You're like watching his video and interrupting it. It was great. Yeah. It was classy. But
that was a classic moment. That's something I may put on my channel just for the fun of it because that was one of the things I had to do.
Well, and it's also the fact of look at these people that are out there saying that this didn't happen. And hey, man, like I worked for a guy here locally. He's a good guy. Like as far as I guess you know. The president saying anybody's a good person, you know, like we all we're all good people deep inside. But the guy said a bunch of kids didn't die at a school. And I was like, hey, man, like a bunch of kids died. No, dude, like you can't say a bunch of people didn't die. They did.
That's true. I have no clue who you're talking about. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. He's been deplatformed on everything but his own website.
Exactly. You know, the people who do that, they don't understand the harm that they're causing.
Yeah.
They think, if they think they're in the right, that's fine. They have the right to their opinions. I would never tell somebody you don't have a right to your opinion.
Absolutely.
But when you start telling people your opinion is fact.
Yes.
And you look at someone and says your kid did not die, or your daughter did not
that's
die,
right.
Your husband didn't die. You know, all of these different things, and they're all crisis actors and things like this.
Yeah.
That's when you start turning, you start crossing a line, and you cross a line with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And if you don't expect someone to call you out on that, because they think they're calling me out on it or yeah. other researchers out on it,
mm-hmm.
and they're living in that psychosis world, and they believe the stuff that they're saying, but you have to wonder, in the back of your mind, do you really, really believe that no one died? I mean, come on. So
yeah.
those are the things that just irk me. And then, you know, combine that with the fact that he said that if someone comes down and gives one of his people, one of the people that he knows, any problem, he will come out there and shoot them right between the eyes.
Yeah.
A survivor.
Yeah.
A survivor coming to the second year reunion. This guy was going to go out, and if anyone had any problems, he would shoot that person right between the eyes.
Yep.
And that got him in trouble.
Yeah, most definitely, because that is a call to action. That is a promise of action. And that's something that we have to be careful in this day and age. And even nowadays with this show, not even nowadays, forever and always with this show, I have made it a point that whenever I say something is my opinion, be it my educated opinion mm-hmm. or my ignorant opinion, I firmly state the fact, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
Even earlier, whenever I was talking about my hearsay conjecture theory about why the tanks were shot at, I made it a point to say, this is my opinion. This is what I think. And granted, until you cleared that up, that was one of the only things that ever went unanswered is why did
and
he shoot
still,
at the tank?
People still come out and they wonder, well, how are you so certain? And blah, blah, blah. I'm certain because I was there. I'm trained to look at this stuff and all of these other things that go along with it. And after a certain point, it becomes there is no other conclusion to come to. But if anyone has an issue out there that's going to come up there and go after Christopher or someone else, I just say, just wait a little while and wait till I'm there and just come after me. Just if you're going to point all your frustrations, you come after me and we'll talk. You know, and we'll take care of it. That's not a threat. Just let me know.
No.
I'll be the person to be the spokesperson.
Absolutely not.
Yeah,
but I mean, for me, this has been one of the ongoing causes of this show is to bring this truth to light, to follow this through to the end and find out why. Because you guys had exclusive access to Eric Paddock as opposed to any other show in the country, as opposed to any other.
Nope.
He did a couple of offhand interviews at the beginning, but when they twisted things to some end, he was like, no, I'm done with people.
He was done with the media. He was tired of it. Once he knew that the Review Journal was basically backing, you know, Sheriff Lombardo, he was done with Review Journal. And we were on the phone, and actually he called me and he says, hey, you know, you left a couple of messages on my machine. I've been watching you. And I want you to be the person that I talk to. If I need to talk to the media, I'll talk through you. And I'm like, okay, well, I was kind of like worried about it. Like, is this one of those things where it's going to have a big negative impact or a positive impact or anywhere in between? But either way, I wanted to do that for him. And I didn't want to like exploit him because you haven't seen me like parade him around on all these different shows and stuff.
Yeah.
I tell him if you want to do something, yeah, no problem. But that relationship has actually developed into somewhat of a friendship. And I talk to him at least once a week. And he's just an all around really interesting, he's eccentric guy, but he's just cool as hell.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But his brother did a very bad thing. And a lot of people, you know, when they look at somebody and they say, how can you be friends with him? His brother killed. I'm like, come on, man. He didn't do it. You know, and you know, he's, I guess people just think that people that are from a family that's somewhat estranged, and yeah, the family's got issues, and who's doesn't? I'd compare mine to anybody any day.
Well, but, now granted, not everybody's family has the 10 most wanted in it.
This is true.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes from Eric. Is that our family's crazy, whatever. Like our dad was on the 10 most wanted list. You know,
exactly.
Like
dad committed a bank robbery. Vault,
okay.
That's true.
But at the same right, like I have interviewed the purported niece of D.B. Cooper on this show.
Yes, you did.
You know?
Yes, you did.
And that's also one of those cases where it's like, how is it? The D.B. Cooper case was still open when this was closed. This was closed and D.B. Cooper was still open.
Yep.
Because
exactly.
They literally could not take the kick to the nerds that this was the one unsolved airline hijacking ever.
And now
they could
down
not
here
take
in,
that
in,
kick
in
to
Lakeland,
the nerds.
With another case that's been reopened now. It's 23 years old with the Don Lewis case, so, you know, with the Carol Baskin / Joey, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And, you know, this case is, I can't get into it, obviously, because it's still ongoing, so I can't discuss anything that's happening right now.
But, man.
It's been bizarre. Whenever you get, I would do these things, and I would just do them in the background. I'd just get evidence, go give it to the person that needs it. And then I go on about my merry way. No one would ever even know I was there. I was there the next day at Pulse. No one knew I was there. I didn't go on TV. I didn't put up a blog, and I didn't put up YouTube stuff. So a lot of people, you know, in the beginning when they would tell me, you're doing this so you can become famous and you can do this and that. I'm like, no, because I would have done it. And this is number 13. Well, actually, this one that I'm at right now is number 14, but you know, Las Vegas was number 13. So I had done 12 major investigations before. And in those, I just gave the evidence to the people I thought that needed it, that would benefit the victims of the crime, anything that I could find that would help the families of the victims and the survivors and so forth. That's what I did.
I do it, Mike. I do it for the glory myself.
Absolutely.
It's for the women. You get throngs of women doing this.
Yes, you do. Absolutely. And I saw the cape when I was over there. I saw the cape on your wall, and I saw Amy staring at it going, you're not pulling that cape out tonight.
Well, it's my power, my glove power in the background. My Infinity Gauntlet is what it is.
Yep.
Literally, it's kind of one of those things. And I told Sev Talk this. She comes on the show. She is an alien contactee. And I tell her all the time, the reason why I believe people is because I myself had what a lot of people would go, okay, crazy person. Sure, you felt God in the room with you. You felt God speak to you. Sure, you did. Okay.
Yeah.
What were you drinking again? All right.
Exactly.
You know,
the wackadoodle meter goes off, and everybody's it's like each person has their own. Their own story that is so powerful and so meaningful to themselves that it takes on an extraordinary, a phenomenal type situation where you can only attribute it to either a religious experience, some spiritual thing, some alien thing. It has to be something that's beyond normal. And when you do that, other people, even people that believe in the same stuff you do, will look at you and go, Well, let me tell you about my story. It's like everybody wants you to hear their story, but you tell them your story, and they're like, sure. But then you meet people that all get together, and they all have a common belief, and they can relate to things. And that's where I end up being the bad guy of the bunch. That's why I get so much heat on YouTube and stuff, because I'm the guy that comes in that blows everybody's story, and they get mad at it because I always have some sort of scientific explanation for what just happened, and they don't want to hear that. And I've learned over time that I really need to just shut up. These people had this experience. And I've had an experience that I can't explain either.
Sure.
And I realize now if I say that to people, they think I'm a little out there, but I even videoed a couple of mine, and I was like, I'm not putting this video on anything ever.
That's all me, but I'll show, I think I showed you a couple books.
Well, you have. And it's literally one of those things of what do you have to gain by coming forward?
Right.
You know, when you're talking about people, a prime example would be one of my dream guests, you know, Travis Walton, the inspiration for the movie Fire in the Sky. When you're talking about people like that, whose lives were literally ruined, not only by this experience, but by coming forward.
Exactly. Like, the experience itself was traumatic enough, but coming forward was absolutely just beyond.
It's like,
I even look at people like Bob Lazar, who's probably absolutely full of crap. But if he's, if anything in there is true or true to him, it's utterly, he's never made a dime off of this. He's never come out, you know, he sounds kind of like me in a way. He's had these extraordinary experiences, and he, no one, I don't get paid. No one pays me for this stuff.
No.
And you come out and you just sit there and you tell your story, and then everybody just throws you under the bus left and right. And sometimes you, you know, I've done things to myself that that make myself get in trouble, because I'm like, okay, I'm gonna have a little fun with this one, because these people are just going to lambast me anyway. So let me just give them some crazy crap to
go
along.
Not
going
to lie, sometimes it's fun to buy a ticket to the bus.
Of course, or to buy a ticket to be under the bus.
Well, yeah. Hey, let's go see what that's all about.
That's the place I'm comfortable being, is under the bus. I kind of live there, I think.
But it literally is the fact of, you know, you have to be, even myself with having this show, you were one of the good people that whenever I had Anonymous on the show, you were one of the people that was swatting flies away from my website.
Yep.
And keeping things alive, you know?
That was we were 2 minutes from you going live.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, and then you went live and it was still kind of going on, and I'm trying to do some battling in the background for you. It was crazy.
I mean, you know, to know that this show even came under DDoS attack because of content that it was having on. That made me feel good. When my night when it was happening and I was going live to Facebook, my wife was like, "You are so calm right now. Like, I can't believe you are not more upset." And I was like, "Do you realize what a beautiful point this is?"
Yeah.
Like, the fact that my site is trying to be taken down right now and coming under DDoS attack means that what I'm doing is right.
Yep. It's just like Navin Johnson when he's looking at the cans, or he gets that phone book and he goes, I'm somebody now.
I'm somebody.
They hate cans.
My name in print.
That's actually mine and Rance's favorite movie today.
That's what it takes. Your name in print. Yep.
Exactly. You got to find that special purpose.
Look out for the cans.
Yeah.
Look out for the cans. And
but one thing is too, there's not a lot of the glitz and glamour and all this other stuff. When you're doing this type of work, there's really no rewards. You're not going for anything. There's no thing at the end of the year where somebody says, an investigator of the year, or armchair investigator of the year, or a guy that solved the crime that no one else could, that 1,100 FBI agents couldn't figure out. You know, there isn't any of that.
The podcast that dropped bomb content this year.
Exactly. So when you come into this, you have to be doing this for the right reasons. And what happens is, over time, people will see who is still here, who is still actually, you know, trying to make certain that the evidence is preserved, or whatever is necessary, or if they just need help. There's a lot of survivors out there I still try to help and work with on a daily basis, as best I can. I'm not, you know, I can't do everything, but they people still want to know what really happened, because they believed one thing for a long time, and then
That's just it. Like, people want to know what really happened. And when it comes to something like this,
And I have people that come up to me that say, hey, and they tell me their name, and I remember the name, and they were the ones that were just going nuts on me in the beginning. And they say, look, I was really bad on you, or whatever. And it says, I'm not only want to apologize to you about all of the things I said to you and called you a shill and a government this and an agent that, but I just want to let you know that you were right all along, and I was living in some dream world, and I wanted to believe that all this other stuff was happening, because it had to be bigger than it than it really was. It had to be all of these different things. And, yeah. they, and for them, that was a weird comfort zone. But well, that's what happened.
And to really get down to the tater and the French fry here, Mike, yeah. so to speak, what exactly was it? Because it wasn't his work with Lockheed Martin and no, wanting to expose no. something. It wasn't... It wasn't the fact that he was wronged by the government or had any kind of political no. agenda. So far as we no. can tell from family, from life, things like that, what was it that brought Stephen Paddock to this point?
Most of the information that I have comes from going to the sources, going to Eric, who knows him better than anyone else, and just to get if you get into the mind of Eric and his interactions with Steve, you kind of got an idea of Steve. And then when you looked at some of the other things, because we don't have any recordings of Steve talking. We don't have any recordings of him, you know, at a birthday. We don't have nothing.
We got
on this
plenty
guy,
of security footage of him.
Yeah, we got plenty of security footage and of him sitting at a video poker machine. And that's pretty much it. But when you start piecing together the things, he was a pilot. His passion was he loved to fly. And he couldn't take his blood pressure medication because it made him sick to the point where since he couldn't take it, he was not cleared to fly. So he lost his pilot's license.
Yeah.
So that was one. He had an estranged relationship with his other brothers. That was another situation. And then he had the father was, you know, it was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And then he's got, you know, a situation with Mary Lou Danling. And then he's got all of these different things when you add them all up and then combine that with the fact that the only joy he had in life was to go to the casino and be treated like a king, because he was a big fish in the little pond when he was at Reno. But then when he went to Vegas, that kind of switched around a little bit. And when they started taking the comps away from him, that was the moment that he realized he was getting screwed. And he felt like, that was it. That's all he had left.
That was quite honestly the one audio clip I wanted for tonight that I was not able to get, and it made me very sad, was the clip from the documentary and the bell guy that had been a bell guy for years and knew him and was like, I've seen this scam. I've seen what they do where they bait these big rollers, these high rollers, to come in. Yep. They guarantee them a comp corner room. Stuff like that, and then they show up and the whole block of rooms is filled, but for $500 bucks we can give you an upgrade.
And that's exactly what they did. And he got so pissed off one time that when he came in there, they wouldn't give him a room, they wouldn't comp the room, so he went over and sat down at a machine and spent over $1 million running it through that machine. He didn't
like the room,
the whole million
to get
the
room.
He just ran it through the machine, and he got the room.
Hey, man, I got a friend of mine's dad who will remain nameless, but this man is literally like a second father to me. He literally knows my son better than my dad. And Pop, I love him so much. He's a man that's getting up in age. You know, he's in his in his early 70s, stuff like that. Has a decent credit line, right? And you know, gets cards for $10,000, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Well, you got a card, you know, unlimited black card, whatever. And just old manned it, you know, bought something on it. And you know, put in the wrong number to pay him, whatever.
Right.
Had great credit with these people for years and years. So he calls him up and he's like, hey man, sorry I was late on that payment. Here's the money. I'd like to pay it in full. Is there any way that we can have that $40, fee? I got this crazy credit limit with you guys. I've been working with you for years. Yep. No way we can do it. So like, I have a $10,000 limit with you, but you can't waive a $40 fee for an $85 purchase.
Right.
That I was late on because of an honest mistake. Nope. We can't wait. Sorry, sir. No. And he tried and tried. Nope. So you know what he did, Mike? He went out to his gold guy. He paid him their late fee. He cleared his account. Then he went to his gold guy and maxed out the card and then cut it and never paid him a dime.
That's the way to do it.
He's like, what are they going to do? I'm like in my mid-70s. My credit's great. I like my house is paid for and it's not my name. My car is paid for and it's not my name. Like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? He had the opportunity stick it to the man, and he did.
Right. Hey, look into the chat and see if anyone's asked. I think because we kind of like said we would answer some questions, or whatever. See if there's any questions that are lingering that might be important there.
There have been a couple that came through. Okay. One of them was mainly have you seen symbols of power or secrets hiding in plain sight, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, nothing really major that we have not covered in this show. So yeah, I mean, for at least
I
in the
make sure we cover those
at least in the case, video that I have going. Granted, the way that Facebook shares video now is totally different than the way it used to be, which is kind of sad because it stopped a lot of the instant sharing of things and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's almost like you have to do the show, and because I was looking at it too, I got OBS and all these different programs that are running in the background, and I'm sitting there going, for me to run a multi-platform show live and to have people answer or ask questions live on multiple platforms, almost impossible. So you either have to do a show, like pick your platform that's going to be your main one and just say, okay, I'm going to do, it'll be YouTube or Facebook or whatever, and that be the main platform you do the show on, and then either do it again or you just run it as a premiere on the other one and then, try to work it that way. It's just that someone needs to get together and, StreamYard actually did pretty good when they were getting those two together, but still the chat doesn't all come together. You have to keep looking around different screens and you get distracted, and it's hard to do a show when you get in that flow, so I get that.
Yep, and we did have quite a few people tune in on Spreaker, stuff like that. Thank you so much, Michelle Leonard and Summer Maxwell, for the conversation you guys have had sustaining on there, talking about the disgusting pigs of the LVMPD. And it's even gotten to the point where I've noticed things get blocked for me whenever I go to Vegas.
Right.
Just because that's how algorithms work. It's definitely gotten to the point, I will say this, because quite a few of the times that I've gone to Vegas in the last year, I have worked night shift. And I will say, it's gotten much more frequent that security comes by every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And knocks on doors or just straight up comes in.
Right. I was amazed at how little interaction I had with security when I was there, especially with, being on Fox News there, going up in the elevators and they have my picture and Laura Loomer's picture on every screen throughout the place. Other than the 13 cops that took me out of the foundation room that night, other than that, it's been pretty much nothing. No one's ever really done anything. No security has ever stopped me from going up a service elevator in any hotel in Las Vegas, including the Wynn, which that one was the funny one. That's actually the one that got Eric to want to talk to me. He says, when I watched your Wynn video of you cut, when Steve Wynn comes on there and says, no one has ever come into a Wynn facility ridden the service elevator. I was challenge accepted, buddy. And I was the next day.
Challenge.
And that's what Eric saw, and that's the video that he said he watched. And once he watched that, he says, "You're my kind of scum," and those were his exact words. I said, "Well, I don't know if that's a compliment or not. It sounds like a Star Wars reference, but sure, okay."
But I mean, most definitely, whenever you're talking about people like you, Ram, even Jim, the investigator going on in the show that y'all are currently working on, that kind of mutual respect when it comes to those things is so horribly important. Like Ram was saying, to be able to trust the fact that, hey, go out and do what you do. I'll meet up with you tomorrow and we'll compare notes,
And I think people are going to see that, and I can't get into details, but I think over the next few days, maybe into the next week, I don't know when it will air or whatever, but what you're going to see coming out of here is two people getting together who absolutely have the best attributes of either side,
get together and actually come through with some really interesting stuff. So that's something I'm super excited about. So I'll hang around down here in mid Florida for a little while.
Well, man, and I am so excited for you guys, for everything that's going on in the wake of Money Machine, in the wake of the incredible work that you guys have done, even to be invited in on these other projects because of it and because of your work in that, is huge and high compliment.
Yeah, it is. It is. And if somebody had told me 2 years ago that I would have been on the largest Mashing U.S. history, and then somehow, some way, by whatever act of whoever, come in on this Tiger King thing, I would never have thought it, but you know, everything lined up. Ramsey did something amazing. And you told you the story earlier of how it actually happened. And, you know, so to have that is just, you know, and I'm not a religious person, but the lack of a better term, it's a blessing. That's the only word that comes to mind that actually makes sense.
Yeah.
And it truly is. I'm honored. And, I'm going to move forward, and this will be a springboard for me to do some other things that I've been wanting to do my whole life, and never really had a way to jump into it, because you have a skill set and then you can't use it. It's not a normal thing you use in civilian life. So when you finally get a chance to use it and people go, wow, there was a person they were looking for like 5 months down here. And it was put to me, and they said, hey, there was like a test. It was like, here you go. If you can find this guy, cool. So 15 minutes later, I contact this person back and said, here they are. And they're like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
So those kind of things are, that just makes you feel like you're truly wanted, because last year was a bad year for me. I lost my brother, my mother, I lost Catherine, I lost my sister, my whole family's gone, and I'm sitting there going, wow. And I was ready to check out or not really do anything anymore. And these kind of things, when I see that I can help other people, and some things are just a little bit, if I can do something for somebody else, it gives me a sense of worth, a sense of meaning. And that helps me and it helps them. And there's no better feeling in the world.
Yeah. And I mean, this is one of those shows that I guarantee you, much like the comments that have happened this evening on Threads, even from History Channel hosts that have been on the show, we're watching this evening. Thank you so much, Bingo, for tuning in regularly. But it's the fact of, you don't do it for that. You're doing it for the case of getting facts out there. I mean, even the fact that tonight was my 8th wedding anniversary, yet still here I am in the back room because my wife knows me and knows what I am and who I am. And the fact that this show and this topic means something to me.
And that's awesome. I think we actually had another show one time where there was a birthday or anniversary or something then too. I was like, I keep robbing your celebration.
Oh no. I mean, no offense. You even guest bombed Ramsey last time he was on.
Oh yeah. That's right. I did do that.
You was called funny. Up that, in the middle of the show.
Well, it was almost like it was orchestrated, but that was cool. That was cool. That was an awesome moment. That was so
funny. But, and I mean, thank God for good people like Shannon Caffey, who connected us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who connected me with Ramsey, who connected me with you, who has really been a backbone through all of this, I think, for the three of us. A real person that has been there, that is tied into the community, that is boots on the ground. It's great because Ramsey in Vegas.
I've met so many people doing this. I don't mean to take away from that,
thank everybody that you can right now. 3 years later, man, do it.
Yeah. Three years later, just all of the people that I've met in this investigation, whether it be and some of them are gone now. We've got Kathleen Lombardo gone. We've got some of the others that are gone. I've lost 6 friends since I've done this. I lost my whole family since I've done this. My family's gone. And
you know, not my daughter down, but from myself up, you know, my siblings and further. And so I look towards other people, and the people that I've met, you know, like Michelle and Roger and CL, and you know, just I could just go completely down the list of all of these wonderful people that have just made this all worthwhile, made it so, you know, here I am 3 years later, I'm still here. You know, everybody was looking at, well, you know, in the beginning, these people come in and they attach themselves to the Jake Morfonius, the Laura Loomer, and, you know, John Collin, all these different people. But, you know, I just feel like there's something about this case that's kept me with it. And it's forever a part of me. It's just not going to go anywhere. And the people that I met are just so special to me now that I can't, you know, think of doing this without them. And when it comes down to it, when you have Shannon and Andrea, when you go back to the very beginning, first people I met, the very first person I met was actually Stephanie Cook. And she, you know, she couldn't sleep at night. And literally every night I was on the phone with her for like 3 weeks, and she was near the first person that was shot. And it was kind of bizarre at the time, because I just talked to her every night and she'd go to sleep, blah, blah, blah. And then it was the multiple shooter thing, and she would dream about this stuff. And then she'd call me like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd answer the phone and say, we'd talk for a little while, and then she'd be okay.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine. I've sat there with Shannon even in my hotel room and been like, dude, I cannot even imagine 11 minutes of fire. Right. That is a shot a second. Yep. At a minimum.
1,100 rounds.
He was crazy. Popping like 1.1 rounds a second.
Yep. And you then know? You have like, you know, like CL. She was in there the entire time.
That is frightening, man, when you consider the fact that most soldiers in the field only experience sustained fire up to 5 to 8 minutes.
Right.
And that's a soldier in the field who is like battle hardened, somebody who's been trained to go through this and still comes out with PTSD. Now imagine your average Domino's driver who is out enjoying a concert.
Right. And that's the difference of everything. These people went to go have a good time or whatever. And of course, when this thing starts, when you're out in the field, and you're in a theater somewhere, people may not know what the word theater is, but if you're in a military version of the word theater, and when you're there and everything starts happening, you're kind of expecting it, and you're hyper aware. You're
looking
for stuff,
you're
whatever.
Signed up for something.
Exactly. And you're at a concert and all of this stuff breaks out. It changes your view of life in general.
Yeah.
These things, you go to an outdoor event or whatever, these are like, remember when PTSD was not a thing? It was like, yeah, okay, sure, yeah, you got post-traumatic stress disorder.
Remember when average people didn't have PTSD?
Yep. Right. And now it is a real thing. And we've known it's been real for a long time, and it's pretty well now accepted. But there's different levels of it and different types of it. And it's just when you're with someone, and it's so weird, because I was with someone a few months ago, and just certain sounds, you know, are a trigger. And I knew what was going on. And the other person was like, snap out of it. What's wrong with you? Come on. What's your problem?
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, dude, you know, dude. And this is the girl's boyfriend. And I'm like, dude, chill out. And he's like, that's my girl, dog. What are you doing? I'm like, dude, chill. I was ready to knock this guy out. And, you know, but I took him off the side. I talked to him. I said, listen, here's a real situation. She also has an anxiety attack, so you don't know which one's happening at the time.
Yeah.
And if you don't identify these things, it could present a huge problem down the road. If you love this girl, you need to learn this stuff. She's not going to snap out of it. You know, you got to help her. So, and that's the difference. You know, it's just, you know, people who care or people that have any empathy. You know, sometimes you wonder if people have empathy anymore.
Well, and that's something that we talk about regularly on this show. That's something that my wife and I have been talking about regularly here at the house, is that if anything, I think maybe the horrendousness of this COVID epidemic has brought about a new realm of empathy.
Yep. You know what? That's a very good point.
Because there's like 9/11 touched a lot of people. It hit a lot of people. Yeah. It definitely changed the world in a way. You know, it definitely changed the way that the world traveled.
Right.
And the security measures it took to travel. But this is different. With COVID, we're talking about something that by the end of it, A, we'll never see the end of it. It's a virus. There are very few viruses that we have, like smallpox. There's one.
Right.
I give you one that we have stopped.
Yeah, but then you get the anti-vaxxers out there, and then some things start sneaking back into the system. But, you know,
but
everybody has a reason for doing what they do. I get that. And somehow, in most ways, you have to respect that scenario as well. But when it comes down to COVID, this literally has affected everybody on the planet.
Exactly.
Even as downplayed as it is, and the fact that the mortality rate has gone really low on this thing. But the number of people are still, the actual numbers are high, but the actual mortality rate is low. So a lot of people look at it and go, well, you know, you got less than 1% this or whatever. And they look at other things that are much higher. Like I'm sitting here in the middle of Florida. I can tell you this. If you go into a normal store here, not like a big box retailer, very few people are wearing masks. I mean, like nobody. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you kind of grow, because you're in more of a rural area here in Lakeland and stuff. So you kind of used to it, right? You're kind of okay with it in your mind, but you know what you're doing is wrong and you could do whatever. But for some reason, it just becomes accepted. But then when you go, so you walk into Best Buy, you walk into Walmart, you know damn well you got to put that mask on. So it's going to be conditioning. It's just getting people to do this. When you're in Europe or if you're over in Asia, they all wear the mask. It's almost everybody over here.
Well, it's
not
been,
so much.
It's
and
been
that's part of the reason
that
why
the
we
masks
got a problem.
Have existed in Asiatic countries since the original version of the avian flu.
Yep.
Back
I remember
in Bush's
the first
era.
Time I went to China, I was like, what is up with these people? Everyone wearing these damn masks. And there wasn't the flu going on, but they are so conditioned to wear masks whenever that person has something or someone near them has it or whatever. They do it. And
it's the fact of being socially responsible.
Right, right.
You know, the fact of whether or not I have it, I have been exposed to people that have it and you have not. So this is the least I could do.
Yeah, I almost had a Karen video the other day. Almost had a Karen video. I was pulling out my phone and this woman in the Dollar General store was just freaking the hell out. And I was like, oh, well, and I couldn't get the phone to go. And then someone called me, and I was wanting to throw the phone on the floor. I was like, and then
I'm
it
sorry,
like
I called
I was
Mike.
At that point. It looked like I was the Karen. I was getting so mad at the phone. I was like, and then she starts looking at me. You're like, what's wrong with you? I was like, well, I was about to film you, you stupid Karen, but damn it, somebody called me.
You're lucky somebody called. You were about to be internet famous.
But
that's the thing is that opposed to 9/11, this is really something that come the end of it all, we will all be either directly impacted or know somebody directly impacted, whether they caught it or have family that caught it or they lost their job or had to change their job or what have you. And that is world over. So this is one of those few situations where a commonality comes about.
Yeah.
With
9/11, you knew exactly where you were at the very moment you first heard about the planes hitting the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And it's like that John F. Kennedy moment. This is our John F. Kennedy moment is the 9/11 event.
Yeah.
And then you move forward to COVID. You don't really have that moment. But I kind of remember mine is when we have a group of Intel guys, we get together and we chat on the phone and we talk about some secret crap here and there. And so while we were talking, one of the guys kind of, said, you guys realize that December 31st isn't the date. November, blah, 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 is not the date. October 17th isn't the date. We are back into September of last year when this actually first started. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, the rule, cause anytime somebody says something like that during our calls is they have to back it up. And so he basically backed it up and we were sitting there going, okay, so we're sitting on information here that we can't tell a soul in the world, but at the same time, our own intelligence community does know it. And it goes back to September
and it goes away, not away from Wuhan, but it goes kind of a little bit away from how this was told to us that was started.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to December 31st. China sat on that until December 31st.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can blame them so much, but then we got to blame ourselves too, because look at what, how, you know, how we've handled it. I'm not saying necessarily Trump is the problem or
because no offense, you could jump on the man about firing a pandemic response team. The fact is that pandemic response team had no plan on record, folks. They had zero plan on record on how to deal with something of this size and scope. None.
True.
None. Yep. And that was after the practice of 60,000 deaths due to swine flu. And I am not a fan of our current president.
Didn't they see the movie? I mean, that was the plan, right? That's what I thought. I thought, gosh, just go watch the frickin' movie and come back. But no, they didn't watch the movie, I don't think.
I tell my wife all the time, it happened because it's in the script.
Yep.
Just have to make sense. It was on page 8.
And all these... Exactly. It's in the script. Just call the director and find out what the next scene is supposed to do and do it.
But, it has been a roller coaster of a ride since this first started. I did confirm it, actually, earlier. I'll pop it back up on screen right now. It was Dudes and Beer, episode 128. Terror at Mandalay Bay, Mass Shootings and Gun Laws in America with Michael Cargill was the episode. That was the first episode dealing with the Mandalay Bay Massacre. And I had friends that were actively working a show at Mandalay. I had people that were working that concert going on outside. And it's crazy to hear all of these things from all these different points of view, but the way that you and Ramsey especially, put this together for Money Machine.
Absolutely.
I cannot wait for my third watching, because it's typically my third watching where I truly get to absorb a lot. And my God, this documentary has so much in it. Even watching it for the second time today and going through and making my pages of notes.
Right.
There is still so much more out there. So,
dude, I'll just let you know this. I have 19 terabytes, not gigabytes, terabytes of footage, of my own footage, of things I've never shown anybody, because at the time I didn't know if it was going to be necessary for the lawyers, and I just kind of like sat on it. So I've got all kinds of crazy stuff that I'm going to, you know, basically put out there. I know
you have access to literally over 120 hours of footage.
Yes,
it's insane.
Yep, absolutely,
it's insane.
Yep. And and I have the original Eric Paddock interview. I mean, all anyone's seen is the pieces that we put into the movie. And I did my own separate interview with him, and we sat down there, but I never put it out because I wanted to make sure the movie came out in full release before I, you know, put that out there. I did, because it'd be like stepping on my own toes or stepping on Ramsey's toes. So that's going to come out, and it has a whole bunch of different questions that no one's ever heard answered before. And they're going to be like, well, you said about this out first because this is evidence. And did it? And I said, oh, no. Okay. I went through it to make certain that wasn't the case, or if it was, I got that information to the people that needed it.
Well,
but it's crazy. This whole thing has just been an experience that, I mean, obviously you can't forget it, but it's just something that actually shapes your life. My life has changed forever, even though I wasn't there that night.
Same. And it's because of people like Shannon. It's because of people like Maurice. Yep. It's because of people like the witnesses in your documentary and other people that I have personally met that were there on the ground that night and hearing their stories, where it's like, I cannot leave this to bear. I cannot just leave this the way it is, because the story is totally untold.
Exactly. And there's some people that they don't know how important their story, their piece of the puzzle, actually ended up becoming.
Yeah.
And that's the story I want to get out, because there's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes to where we needed information, or their lawyers needed information. And it was, let's say it's like Corey Langdon in her video. Mm. Yeah. He doesn't know how important that video is. I mean, it's just absolutely beyond the measure of importance that that probably a lot of people realize. And there's a bunch of stories like that. Like, and yeah. there's unanswered stories, like the two people at the bus stop. Those two people,
yeah,
they don't realize how important their story is to this whole thing. It's incredibly important. But
the whole camera footage that you found for hours that the FBI was like, Matt, yeah, whatever.
when you put all this together, it makes things make a little more sense to a senseless act. It's a senseless act that you're trying to make sense of, and it's never going to make sense, but you're trying to make it make some sense, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, most definitely. And you know, the fact that there is all of this information out there, all of these stories out there, all of this just sets up for an incredible story in the background. And to see what has come out from survivors, what has come to bear from lawsuits, what has come to bear from the fact that the LVMPD is under lawsuit for not releasing public documents. That's horrifying. Right. That's horrifying.
Yeah. And that case is over. They went to the Supreme Court
and lost.
They gave it up. They were like, okay, well, I guess no one really cares anymore. I'm like, no, I'm sitting here screaming at the phone.
I care.
Yeah, because it's time to watch. Yeah, I care. We all want it. It's not going to, like, you know, we're going to comb through this footage and find the other shooter or see a helicopter.
There is no other shooter.
There's no other shooter.
He wasn't trying to take out Janet Airlines. None of that stuff was happening. Was it the fact that the guy was probably ticked off and had nothing better to do? Sure. Right. Absolutely. But
they probably thought I was trying to take out Janet Airlines because the cops got me walking over towards well, I won't say exactly what I was doing at Janet Airlines, but I've got video of an LVMPD officer coming down the street and puts me on his car right there in front of Janet Airlines. I'm going, well, this will be a video that everybody's going to appreciate one day.
but I mean, as much as I would love it to be something along those lines, it simply isn't. The fact is, why has there been no motive given?
Right.
Why has it been wrapped up in such a slipshod manner?
They had 25 people that they hired for the it wasn't even the behavioral analysis unit. Remember, they call it the BAU report.
Yeah.
It's not the BAU report. It's the Las Vegas whatever the hell group they called it. Las Vegas Research Group, I think it was. And they've hired 25 people from several different walks of life and different job professions. One was even a pedophile research, you know, psychiatrist or something. I'm like, okay, well, that's obviously for Bruce. That has nothing to do with a whole bunch of stuff. But apparently Steven has some stuff on his computer. But you have these people, and they sat in a room, and they pored over the evidence that was there, and they came up with the conclusion that gave us those 10 points on a 2.5-page report that everyone sat there and went, wow, 2.5 pages? We're waiting for this report. I think it's going to be easily over 1,000 pages because all the other reports of the mass shootings are over 800 to 1,000 pages. And we get this 2.5-page report with 10 bullet points. And they had to sit there and go, well, we got 7 bullet points. Well, let's stretch that to 10 so it looks like we worked. You know?
Yeah.
So,
what a kid was stealing from Kroger.
Right.
That's a two-page report.
And as you go down it, and they're trying to make an incredibly complex situation easily understood. A couple of those, right? They really did. And then in the 10, me and Eric just sat there and we looked at each other while I was interviewing. We go, that one's pretty much on point. But for the most part, they didn't get it. And Eric was interviewed for 15 hours, never once by these people. 15 hours. He had like 4 or 5 hours of FBI, 10 hours or so with LVMPD, and that was it. They never really messed with him again. They called him a couple times for a couple of quick questions. That's it. On the largest mass shooting in U.S. history,
Yeah.
The most interview done with a family member was with Eric, and it was for 15 hours and no real follow-up. And the BAU never contacted him.
Well, that's 15 conglomerate hours at that.
Yeah.
Not even 15 hours by one agency.
All right, here's some good news. We've got a great researcher out there. Her name is Michelle. I don't know if she wants me to say her last name, but it's Michelle. And her last name starts with a T. And she put in a FOIA request that everybody's kind of chomping at the bit to get the FOIA request in there. And she got it approved. And the FOIA request that we have coming is 14,000 pages. It's coming, 14,000 pages. It's coming on 28 CDs. They'll be here hopefully within 6 months.
Wow.
And that information is going to go out there, and that hopefully will put, I don't know how many people even know this. I don't think I've ever told you this, but that's a lot of information that we're going to have. Yeah. And that'll keep people busy for another year or two when you really think about it, because that's more information that has, if you take all of the documents and put them together, this is probably 10 times or more over that. So hopefully we'll bring some closure to some other areas that, you know, because there's a lot of areas where people had a report or two that might have an answer of what happened down the street kind of thing, you know.
Sure.
And hopefully that'll help.
And the fact is, all information helps. And whenever you're talking about what was supposed to be a full and thorough investigation where they did not explore stuff literally half a block away, as far as video footage, things like that, that obviously had a great view of the situation and some things going on and accounted for another life being lost.
And there's some other unsung heroes out there that are in the trenches, like LVSA. You got Las Vegas Shooting Archive. I won't say his name, but LVSA has done an incredibly tremendous job. And back in the beginning, Wego was out there doing it, and he had Bob Whittlefish out there doing these things. Everybody piecing together this information, and then you have the YouTube guys that were there doing their part too. Even people that I don't like were at least putting information together. So still to this day, you've got people like Brian Shields. He's out there and he's putting information together. Some of it's a little kooky, but whatever. It's still nonetheless somebody putting the effort to keep this information, or at least the story, in front of the people. And that's important. Even if I don't agree with somebody, it's okay, because the information is coming out. And people are still, you know, they may see his show and his thing and go, well, that may not be what I was really looking for, but at least it gets them back into it, and it keeps it alive. But some people don't want this carried on. They want it to go away, you know, and that's okay too.
I mean,
as long as you come to report, I'm going to be here singing about it. And that Jeremiah Cottle, who did the bump stock, if you listen to this dude, I can get my feet back under me from this thing that's going on down here. There's certain things you don't do. And I know he's got his reasons for doing it, but he's the guy that did the bump stock, and they're suing the victims fund. But I think that's going to probably go away. I think they've gotten to a partial agreement, and they're going to try to get it to you the point where all the information and all of the stuff that involves that will be taken care of. There's apparently some reasoning that he wants a couple of people that are suing him to, if they stop their lawsuit, he'll stop his, and that should work. But if every day it costs money for them to keep that fund going and all this other stuff, those are the kind of things that just need to end, and everybody go the right direction.
Well, and that's just it. It comes to a point where it's really just more about the search for truth now. It's not about pointing blame, things like that, or trying to say multiple shooters, that kind of stuff. It's really more, let's get down to the points of truth. Let's find out what it was about, why it happened, and let's make sure to keep it, like you were saying, in front of the public eye and in the attention of media somehow before another incident like this happens.
And as long as I've got a heart that's beating and lungs that are breathing, I will be getting information as that comes to me out, so I can get that out to the people.
Same.
As best I can.
Same. Mike, thank you so much, as always, for coming on, whether it's for stuff for 5x5 News, whether it's for stuff with the Tic Tac UFOs, all that kind of stuff, or this. To have you and Ramsey on talking about this, like I said, I have had my second viewing of this. Make sure to go by, everybody. Stop on by Amazon.com. Get your copy of it. I think I paid like $9.99 for my copy of the documentary. Utterly worthwhile. I've watched it twice, and my third is, and I mean, I've got, I'll show it here on air. My tablet notes, that just goes on. I think the last time I took this many notes, Mike, and granted, this was a topic that I have had Ram on for 3 times, a topic that I have covered since episode 128, and we are in 290 of this show.
Wow.
You've been on this show more about this than anything else going through my research.
That's true.
But even to go through and see this.
I want to give a shout out to a website I just kind of got on board with. She's actually in the Joe Exotic series from Investigation Discovery. And her name's Tricia. She has a website that's called Web Sleuths. A lot of people have probably already heard about it, but there's actually a couple of places over there to talk about the Las Vegas shooting, which it has its own thread. And I'm kind of like over there a little bit now. And also, you know, they talk about obviously the Tiger King thing and a whole.
They were tuned in by a Spreaker tonight. So thank you guys so much for tuning in.
Absolutely. Yep. Exactly.
And well, with that in mind, Mike, let's tell everybody where they can go to find out more about 5x5 News and everything that you're doing there. And then we'll plug all the stuff for Money Machine.
Okay, well, Money Machine, just go to moneymachinemovie.com. You can also look for Money Machine Movie either on YouTube or on Facebook, and that'll take you to those pages, which will also point you back out to where you can rent the film either on iTunes or Google Play, Amazon, or whatever your favorite VOD platform is. For my stuff, simply just search 5x5 News, which is 5x5 News, or looks like 4x4, but it's 5x5. Either on YouTube and also on Facebook, and look for that, and you'll find all the stuff I've done except for the stuff that got deleted because certain people, you know, decided to take my channel away from me, but that's okay. I'm putting some of that stuff back up. I did find some of it, but anyway, so just 5x5 News or Mike Turber and you'll find me.
Mike, thank you so much for tuning in as always and for being part of the show as always. It's great to have you part of the conversation. It's great to have you here, helping to spread this truth to everybody. Ram, I know you had to split out early this evening, because you had a previous studio commitment to do some ADR work. Good for you, my friend, in this COVID time, for having the gig. Godspeed with that. Thank you so much, as always, for everything that you have done in the production of Money Machine, as well as in your production of what happened in Vegas, and consistently taking on law enforcement and the way that they use media to literally convince us of something otherwise. Mike, please do hold the line while you're online checking out all of that good stuff, everybody. Please do make sure to go on by podcastcadet.com. That is where you can find everything that we do. If you are trying to start a podcast for yourself, friends, family, fun, business, church, school, whatever, stop on by podcastcadet.com today. That is all that we do, is help people launch podcasts, help people start podcasts, help people brand podcasts and audit them. If you're trying to start a podcast, stop on by. We can give you one-on-one personal training. Podcastcadet.com is the website for that. Dudes20 is the code on your way out the door there. While you're online checking that out, make sure to check out dudesandbeer.com. Our knowledge vault has all kinds of great documents, stuff that we used with our good guest Bingo Minerva, as well as great things from Mike Turber. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, you can't be good. Be good at it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, Download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.